This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Thousands of Gulf War veterans are sick, with symptoms including chronic fatigue, rashes, digestive disorders, and memory loss. Many of these vets believe they were exposed to Iraqi chemical or biological weapons. A special White House panel investigating the claims has written a draft of their final report, which concludes there is overwhelming evidence that chemicals were released when American troops blew up an Iraqi ammunition depot in March of 1991. But military logs for the week in question are missing. Last week, General Norman Schwarzkopf and General Colin Powell said they had never seen any confirmed reports of the release of Iraqi chemical or biological agents. My guest Leonard Cole is an expert on the politics of biological and chemical warfare and author of the new book, The 11th Plague. We asked him about the toxins that may have caused Gulf War syndrome.
Initially, when numbers of Gulf veterans started complaining about a variety of symptoms, they were first attributed to stress, post-traumatic stress disorder, moved on to the possibilities of parasite infections, a disease called leishmaniasis, right across to the possibility of pollution from the oil wells, the fires that were burning, and then on to the possible exposure of chemical and biological agents themselves. Now, among the chemical agents that we know that Iraq had in its arsenal were sarin gas, which happens to be the same agent that was used by the cult Aum Shinrikyo in the Tokyo subway system last year. Sarin, tabun, which is another of the nerve agents, they had mustard. So any of the many that we know that were in the Iraqi chemical arsenal could have been released. More than likely, the evidence is that if any of these materials were released, it was not during actual combat by way of Iraq firing these weapons, but more likely after the fighting was over and the stockpiles of these weapons was being destroyed, that some of this stuff wafted into the air and caused some exposure. Do we know that this caused any of the ailments that the veterans now are apparently suffering from? It is not clear. The jury is out.
What is the correlation between the symptoms that the veterans have and the after effects of the chemicals that you've mentioned?
Yes. By the way, I must also mention that there's a chemical called pyridostigmine bromide, which was used as a preventive antidote. Many, many troops, in fact, as many possibly as 400,000 of the troops, took these pills that were given by the Army, which presumably would have helped them resist the effects of certain nerve agents had they been exposed to them. One of the sad problems is that the Army kept no records of who received the pyridostigmine and how many. Some of the troops took them for a day or two, some of them for several months. That also has been seen as a possible cause of the Gulf War syndrome. That is the possible side effects of this material. What are the symptoms? The symptoms range from rash to muscle fatigue to lack of coordination to memory loss, a whole range. Now, how does this coordinate with the possible exposure of actual chemical agents? Well, in a very concentrated form, most of the chemical agents, the nerve agents in particular, would kill a person in a matter of minutes. That is, a tiny drop can actually soak through your clothing if you don't have protective outerwear or if you inhale it, and you would be dead in a minute or two in most cases. So there isn't much time to talk about symptoms. But if you get a moderate exposure, that is, exposure to less concentration or an impure mix of the material, then you initially start with a headache and vertigo. Your body fluids start to secrete. You'll tear a lot. You can feel nauseated. You begin to see different colors. Actually, it really shuts down your nervous system. And so the effects that would be noticeable could range with to cause a variety of symptoms, some of which were those that were reported by the veterans. On the other hand, a person can suffer from chronic fatigue and from muscle disorder and imbalance for reasons beyond just the chemical exposure.
How much research has there been done on low-level exposure to these chemical agents?
You hit a very good point there. Virtually none. I don't know of any long-term research, that is, research for long-time effects of low-level exposure. The presumption had been that unless you were affected quite early on by an exposure to nerve agent in particular, or to mustard, then you would not likely have any long-term effects. That's a presumption. I'm not aware of any scientific studies that have indicated that, that people who had been exposed to low levels then were observed for years after.
I guess I'm wondering if it's possible, or if anybody knows, whether low-level exposure to chemical agents would register immediately in physical symptoms, or whether that low-level exposure might register only slowly over time.
We're getting some hints that the latter of what you suggest is possibly true, that there may be some registration over time. Our understanding until now was that if you didn't get effects early on, you probably wouldn't be getting effects ultimately. And the reason is that the nerve agents work by interrupting the transmission of sensations through your nervous system. And this interruption is relatively short term. That is, it's if it's interrupted in a near standstill state, then you're going to be dead in a few minutes. If it's moderately interrupted, you'll have symptoms fairly early on. But then the material itself, the nerve agent, and then the effects of it dissipate, if you're still alive, to the extent that the original chemical that was there is no longer going to remain in an effective form. It breaks down after a period of time. So it does seem unlikely that 2 or 3 years after exposure, one should first develop some of the symptoms that might be expected from short-term exposure. But again, there's no, I mean, especially with the Gulf War veterans, if their complaints are valid, then this whole question really bears careful looking at.
Leonard Cole is my guest, and he's written a new book called The 11th Plague, The Politics of Biological and Chemical Warfare. You describe the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s as the dividing line on biological and chemical warfare issues. Why?
Well, a lot of what we look at today as seemingly contemporary problems, like the questions about Gulf War syndrome, whether Iraq is still concealing information about its chemical and biological programs, the dangers of terrorism, they really weren't the kinds of issues that we would be talking about had it not been for the war between Iran and Iraq, which took place between 1980 and 1988. The last 5 years of that war, we knew at the time and clearly now have confirmed repeatedly, Iraq was using chemical weapons against Iran extensively. So for a five-year period, long-term, heavy dose, heavy usage of chemical weapons ultimately seemed to have made an outcome, caused the outcome of that war insofar as the Iranians felt that that they couldn't face up to this anymore. The chemicals were frightening. They were debilitating, not only physically, but psychologically. And the general military understanding is that the chemical weapons that Iraq had used actually governed the outcome of that war. Now, that was a terrible, terrible lesson on many counts, because the only time previously that chemicals had ever been used in large measure was during World War I, back between 1914 and 1917. Then the major powers, first one to introduce the weapon were Germany, but then all the major powers who were involved in that war did use chemical weapons. The effects were so horrible. That is, the way people died, these tortured deaths, frothing at the mouth, bleeding from the nose, and the agony, some of whom suffered agonies for the rest of their lives as a consequence of chemical exposure. The effects on the people's minds who knew about these things were so awful that in 1925, the world's nations got together and created an international treaty called the Geneva Protocol. And they banned the use of chemical weapons and bacteriological weapons in war. And that treaty pretty much held. There were occasional infractions. Some countries here and there did use some chemical or biological weapons. But there were hundreds of wars and skirmishes between the time of World War I and then the time of the 1980s when Iraq used these weapons. During that time, there was a pretty good taboo about this. These weapons were seen as beyond the pale.
So Iraq broke the taboo, and you're saying the world allowed that to happen?
Yes. The United States, the European countries, other Asian countries, they let Iraq get away with chemical murder with, it seemed to me, a minimal amount of foresight about where this was going to lead, because the consequences, while not surprising, have been terrible. Many, many countries, especially poor countries that can't develop what they would call the real atomic bomb now started going for these pseudo-atomic bombs, or as they've been called, the poor man's atomic bombs. So that while in the early 1980s we suspected that as many as a dozen countries might have had chemical weapons programs, now our intelligence officials tell us that at least 25 countries have them, and that in 1980 and 81, the U.S. publicly accused only one country of having a biological weapons program. That was the Soviet Union. Now we think that there may be as many as 15 or 17, according to some estimates. So the lesson of allowing Iraq to get away with these weapons for so long was that a bunch of other countries said, well, look, if Iraq can get away with it, why shouldn't we? It's an inexpensive way of creating a weapon of mass destruction.
Were you surprised to find that chemical weapons were used in the Balkan War?
Very much so. There have been news reports of that very recently. I should say I'm surprised to have learned about the fact at this stage because it wasn't commonly known until now. But in the context of knowing that other countries have been developing these weapons, I guess one shouldn't be surprised. One can be very distressed and disappointed about it because it's yet another nail in the coffin of keeping these weapons away from a civilized society.
Well, war is pretty repugnant as it is, and all death is pretty miserable, and certainly death during wars is pretty awful. Why are biological and chemical weapons considered more repugnant than other methods of killing in war?
That's a very good question. I mean, obviously, to a person who is killed, whether by a bullet or a bacterium, it's not going to make much difference, assuming that they don't suffer too much or extensively, or you can suffer as well from a bullet that causes infection and you'll die from it. For reasons that are not entirely clear, chemical and biological weapons, or as they have been called throughout history, poisons, were pretty much taboo. They were always seen as beyond the legitimate pale of use. And this is cross-cultural. Cultures that extended from the Middle East, the times of the Romans, and in Greek society, poisons were seen as just not legitimate in warfare. And this carried through the Middle Ages. Using poisons were considered was considered unchivalrous. Right through the last century or two, when philosophers and lawyers, international lawyers who wrote the rules of warfare, said poisons are out of bounds. Now, this doesn't mean that poisons were not used. They certainly were. But they had and they still do have a certain moral taint or immoral taint that other weapons don't have. This is seen perhaps because they're sneaky. Sometimes they may not be seen as quite as useful because they can be indiscriminate. I mean, if you spray a poison around now, it's not quite clear who's going to get the effect, as opposed to the bullet, which you presumably will aim at a particular person. But for whatever the reasons, we have had a long-standing taboo about the use of these kinds of weapons for thousands of years. And as I say, not only in the Western world. And we've been able to exploit that for the goodness of mankind. There is a treaty called the Biological Weapons Convention, a treaty since 1972 that does ban biological weapons. And the treaty uses a very interesting expression. It says that these weapons are repugnant to the conscience of mankind. And they do have a certain special repugnance and abhorrence that I think we ought to be exploiting, let alone the opposite, which we seem to be doing, allowing people to get away with the use of these kinds of weapons.
Leonard Cole is my guest. He's the author of the new book, The 11th Plague, The Politics of Biological and Chemical Warfare. Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Leonard Cole, the author of the new book, The 11th Plague, The Politics of Biological and Chemical Warfare. The U.S. military actually conducted tests in America of biological warfare using some chemical agents as well. And this was in the years of 1949 to 1969. And some of these tests were conducted in populated areas without the knowledge of the American public. How did these tests come to light?
An enterprising reporter got a hint that there might have been a couple of tests back in the 1950s. And reported this in 1976, so many years after the fact, and he had cited the possibility, as he understood it, that maybe San Francisco was targeted by the Army, and during which time the Army sprayed certain bacteria and chemicals around the city of San Francisco, and there were two or three other places that he named. Since that time, we've learned, and in fact the Army has acknowledged, that At least 239 open-air tests over populated areas were conducted during that 20-year period between 1949 and 1969. And chemicals and biological agents, that is bacteria, were released over populated areas to the extent that probably millions and millions of Americans were exposed, that they were unwitting guinea pigs in these experiments.
And there were Senate hearings on these experiments in 1977?
That's correct. There were, and that's when we first, the American public, first learned the full extent of these experiments.
Tell us about one or two of these experiments in populated areas. How about the one in the New York City subway?
Yes, that has a certain drama to it. In fact, it kind of recapitulated in my mind about a year ago after the sarin incident in the Tokyo subway system. In 1966, for a six-day period, during peak travel hours, the Army had arranged that bacteria called Bacillus subtilis, mixed with some chemical particles, would be released by way of stacking them in light bulbs, and an agent from the Army, a technical person, would come down to the subway platform while there were many, many passengers and people on trains in transit, others waiting on the platform, drop a light bulb filled with these bacteria on the track as the train was coming into the station. Then there were detector apparatuses placed around to measure the concentrations of these bacteria and particles at some distance and some time after the release of these. And the determination was that virtually everybody who was in the subway system during these peak traffic hours were breathing in these materials. They were exposed to them. And had these bacteria been highly lethal and highly pathogenic, or that is, biological weapons, that tens of thousands, if not millions of people, could have become ultimately infected and perhaps died. I might add that the Bacillus subtilis was seen by the Army, or at least declared by the Army, as harmless. The truth is that no bacterium under some conditions is necessarily harmless. You concentrate a heavy dose of this stuff and push it into somebody's face, especially a person who has a weak immune system or a very old person or a very young person. They're called compromised hosts. People can get sick and sometimes die from these bacteria as well.
So what were the Army's conclusions based on the test?
The Army's conclusions were that if certain more lethal bacteria had been sprayed and released in exactly the same way they managed to release these relatively harmless bacteria, that perhaps millions of people could have been infected and died.
Now, there was a class action suit that was recently filed in Minneapolis as a result of some test spraying of a chemical agent over an elementary school in 1953. And there's a scientific investigation into this, and the results are due soon. Actually,
yes.
In January, I think the report will be released by the National Academy of Sciences.
Right,
on this test spraying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, tell us what happened here in 1953.
This is also interesting how often enough, I mean, we've known about this in the public. That is, the information about these tests has been available to the public since the late 70s. And I've written about it periodically by way of articles, op-ed pieces, then a book, actually, in the late 80s. And yet, each time the information comes out and is broadcast, so many people say they didn't know about it before. The tests about Minneapolis were known and understood as far back as the early 1980s. And yet, many people in this town of Minneapolis first learned about them after a television series that was presented in this town of Minneapolis discussed them in 1994, just 2.5 years ago. One of the tests that was involved with a chemical called zinc cadmium sulfide involved spraying many areas in the city of Minneapolis. The effort, by the way, of these tests, the purpose behind all of these tests was to see if these chemicals would spread and how effective they might be if they were really toxic materials, highly toxic materials. And one of the targeted areas was the Clinton Elementary School. And several middle-aged people who at the time in 1953 were young children in the school felt that they may have had harmful effects. They felt disproportionate numbers of incidents of cancer and problems with kidneys and livers. And in a way, it reminds me of the Gulf War syndrome question. Yes, zinc cadmium sulfide could very well have been the cause of toxic problems that the people ultimately suffered. But to prove that this was the case and is the case is going to be very difficult, especially since these tests were done in the early 50s. So you're talking about more than 40 years after the fact. But hundreds of former Clinton students, Clinton Elementary students, got together, and they have been seeking to institute a suit and certainly to look for more information and urge that the government produce information. Their senator, one of their senators, Senator Paul Wellstone, and the congressman who represents Minneapolis, who is named Martin Szabo, were able to get a $1 million appropriation through Congress that funded an investigation that has been going on for nearly 2 years by a committee of the National Academy of Sciences to see what the possible health effects of exposure to zinc cadmium sulfide might be. And that report, as you said, is supposed to be out sometime in late January.
Leonard Cole teaches at Rutgers University and is the author of The 11th Plague, The Politics of Biological and Chemical Warfare. We'll talk more in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Leonard Cole, author of The 11th Plague, The Politics of Biological and Chemical Warfare. When we left off, he was telling us about how the U.S. military conducted tests of biological and chemical agents on unsuspecting Americans from 1949 to 69. Does the American military have a biological weapon and chemical weapon experimentation program now?
Well, we do have. In the case of biological weapons, we've already forsworn our arsenal. In 1969, President Nixon said that he was eliminating the entire offensive capability of the United States in the area of biological weapons. And in 1972, we became parties, or we signed a treaty called the Biological Weapons Convention. And we're parties to it. We're leaders in it. So to the best of my knowledge, we have no offensive biological program. We don't have any stockpiles of bacteria or viruses that we would attack others with. On the other hand, we do have an active defensive program. And the defensive program means we try to develop vaccines or antibiotics or protective gear. The truth is, and you'll hear this from any Pentagon spokesman, that in order to test the effectiveness of any of these defensive programs, you do need some kind of lethal weapon, that is, a dangerous biological agent. And while we keep them in small quantities, presumably, we need them around so that we can test the effectiveness of what we're trying to defend against. The footnote to this, and maybe it should be the headline rather than the footnote, that unlike any other weapon system, since bacteria and viruses can reproduce and reproduce very quickly, if you have a very small number of biological agents around, within a week or two, you can have a huge arsenal of them. I mean, just to give you a quick idea, a single bacterium can divide every 20 minutes when it's given the right nourishment. And if you do some math or take a calculator out, you're going to see that if a bacterium can become 2 in 20 minutes and 4 in 40 minutes and continue to double, you will discover that from that single bacterium, at the end of about 10 hours, you can have a billion. So you can imagine how many billions and trillions and zillions of these bacteria can be developed in a very short time. So the watchword is that even with an honorably or an honorable defensive program, the potential for developing a dangerous arsenal is there, and one has to be on guard against that.
World War I was the war in which chemical weapons were used first and most extensively. How were they used in World War I, and what were they? What were the chemicals?
Yes. In World War I, or in 1914, and then in 15, Germany was the first to introduce a chemical attack, a large-scale chemical attack. I mean, poisons had been used here and there throughout history, but by way of compressing chlorine gas into cylinders, the Germans waited for a certain wind pattern to develop when they were in the trenches near the French, and this was in Ypres in Belgium. And when the wind was right on a sunny afternoon in April of 1915, some 6,000 of these cylinders of chlorine gas were opened up, and when the wind was to the backs of the Germans, and of course, therefore, coming at the face to the face of the French troops who were some hundreds of yards away. And the recording of the time was that these troops were watching a strange yellow-green cloud come at them. And this gas hovered close to the ground, and they didn't run away from it because they didn't know what it was. It was just a kind of strange effect, as they were perhaps mesmerized by it. By the time the gas got to them, they were enveloped and started frothing at the mouth and bleeding, choking, gasping, many of whom died. But that was just the beginning. That was the introduction. And then a variety of other chemical agents were used during the next few years of the war, culminating in 1917 with the Germans' use of mustard gas, which is still considered an effective chemical weapon. Although I must say that recent reports about Bosnia and its use of chemical weapons in the past couple of years against the Serbs indicated that they might have used chlorine gas as well by packing chlorine into some kind of warheads and then shooting out these warheads at the enemy troops.
And the mustard gas causes extensive blistering of the skin?
Blistering of the skin, blindness, and you would be inhaling it, so therefore your lungs would be burned as well. It's a horrible death. I mean, it was largely because of mustard, which had that reputation immediately after World War I, that the world became so disgusted about the effects of chemical agents, or gas as it was then known, that the international treaty came to pass in 1925, the Geneva Protocol.
What treaties now govern the use of biological and chemical weapons, and what is their status?
The two most important treaties are, one, the Biological Weapons Convention, which was first put on the table in 1972. Now there are 139 nations, including the United States, that are part of that treaty. It bans not only the use of biological weapons, but even research or production of them, so that they're pretty much banned from the earth, at least technically by treaty. But there's no way to confirm or verify that countries aren't cheating. The new Chemical Weapons Convention, which was just put on the table for signature in 1993 and now has 160 nations that have signed, including the United States, would not only ban chemical weapons from the earth, it has provisions for on-site inspection, so that if a country thinks that another country is cheating, an outside inspectorate must be available to come in within 24 or 36 hours or so after the charge is made and see on-site whether there's any illegal activity going on. I might say that the United States has signed that treaty, but it is not ratified. It requires 2/3 vote of our Senate in order to ratify. And the Senate was supposed to vote on this in mid-September. Unfortunately, 24 hours before the vote was supposed to take place, then-candidate Bob Dole said that he felt that the treaty was not quite verifiable and would be costly, and he didn't think that it ought to be ratified at that point. And many moderate Republicans, who before had said that they would intend to ratify, decided that they better not cross their party leader at the time. So we're faced with this situation, that the treaty will go into force. 65 nations have already ratified. That's the number that says that the treaty will go into force, and that's going to be in April of next year. If the U.S. is not party to that treaty, we will be setting a terrible example for the rest of the world, suggesting that maybe we don't take chemical weapons seriously enough. So I would hope that we're going to see some early action on the part of the Senate.
Leonard Cole, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure to be with you.
Leonard Cole teaches at Rutgers University and is the author of The 11th Plague, The Politics of Biological and Chemical Warfare. This is Fresh Air.